Listener, did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to target nearly every mood and health concern that you can think of. I'm talking about Mood.com's incredible line of functional gummies. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. Whether that's mind magic gummies for deep work and creativity, PMS support to ease cramps and balance mood swings, or their sexual euphoria gummies to help you feel ready for action and turn every touch into a full body experience. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much anywhere these days, but Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get to the perfect mood. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, listeners get 20% off their first order with code Obscura. Head to Mood.com, find your functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code Obscura when you check out to save 20% off your first order. Listener, Obscura is supported by listeners like yourself. My Patreon is only $3. That's less than the cup of coffee. And if 10% of listeners join the Patreon, that would be a life-changing amount of money. I'm an indie creator, and I rely on listeners like you. But sometimes, I'm not so good at creating calls to action. I can feel a little self-conscious about it. Now, what you get on the Patreon is hundreds of hours worth of bonus content. From Black Label episodes, Obscura episodes, and fireside chats you can't find on the main feed. If you want access to that, head to patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. That's patreon.com/obscuracrimepodcast. And hey, if you can't afford it, I understand. Don't put yourself in jeopardy. Listening is enough. All right, let's get on with it.
Welcome, listener. I'm glad you're here. Take a seat next to the fire.
Welcome to Obscura, where we shine a light on the dark.
Investigators stayed at the house to carefully pick through the debris and determine the cause of the fire. Police arranged for a stunned Deborah and a shocked and distressed Michael and Kate to be questioned separately. According to the Salina Journal, even though Deborah and Kate were in the backseat of the same police car, they didn't console each other or even speak. It wasn't until later that morning, after the dawn had broken, when the home was considered structurally safe to search, that the bodies of Tim and Kelly were recovered. Kelly was found lying in her bed, curled up and appeared to be asleep. She had died of smoke inhalation, even though the door to her bedroom was closed. The body of Boomer, one of the family dogs, was also found underneath Kelly's bed. It initially appeared that Tim had made it out of the bedroom. While it was thought that Tim had almost managed to escape, the Kansas City Star newspaper reported that Tim's body actually had fallen through the ground floor after the second story flooring in his bedroom collapsed. He had died from heat exposure and smoke inhalation near his bedroom, and the significant amount of burns to his body had all been sustained post-mortem. Russell the Greyhound had also passed away in the Inferno. It was during Michael's police interview that he received just about the worst news possible, that his oldest and youngest children had perished in the fire, as did the family dogs. As he grappled to come to terms with the news, the devastated father was open with the police about the difficulties in his marriage and home life, including Deborah's drinking and several threats she'd made in the past to take her own life. Michael had also stated that his ex-wife had said she wished his girlfriend Margaret was dead, that these stresses had been exacerbated by Michael's gastrointestinal illness. Michael told the police that the marriage breakup was tough on Deborah because she was very concerned about money. Michael also stated that he felt Deborah may have intentionally set fire to the house so she could make an insurance claim. However, he had no reason to fear that she would ever harm their children. Immediately following his police interview, Michael initiated divorce proceedings and applied for full custody of his surviving daughter, Kate. However, Kate was explicit that she didn't want to live with her father, so Michael's parents were awarded temporary custody. The court considered Deborah to be incapable of caring for her daughter, but also took Kate's feelings into account about her relationship with her father. After all, thanks to Deborah, Kate continued to blame Michael for making her mother so upset in the first place. Deborah was also cooperative with investigators, telling police that the day before the fire, she picked the kids up from school in the afternoon and took Kate shoe shopping. Everyone came home to do their chores as usual. Then Deborah took Kate to a ballet class before heading off to her own psychiatrist appointment. Kate was excited about her role in the State Ballet of Missouri's upcoming production of The Nutcracker, in which her younger sister, Kelly, was playing an angel. Michael then arrived at the family home to take Tim and Kelly to Tim's hockey game. As previously arranged, Deborah corroborated Michael's statement that he dropped Tim and Kelly off at home later that evening. Deborah stated that following dinner with the kids, she had a couple of alcoholic drinks before retiring to her bedroom. Kate and Kelly went to bed, each taking one of the family's two dogs with them. Deborah told police that when Michael moved out earlier that month, she moved back into the master bedroom, which is where she was sleeping on the night of the fire. According to Deborah, it was in this room that she said she fell asleep between 9:30 p.m. and 10:30 p.m. with the door closed. She stated that around 11 p.m. she woke to find Tim in the kitchen fixing a snack, but that they both went to bed soon after. In a conflicting account later in the interview, Deborah told police that she spoke to Michael around 10 or 10:30 p.m., who she claimed called the house, wanting to know who had paged him, before she eventually fell asleep at 11:30 p.m. Deborah explained that her marriage to Michael had broken down and that they were planning on getting a divorce. She stated that she wasn't upset about it, but acknowledged that Tim and Kate especially were finding it extremely difficult dealing with the upheaval. Deborah later changed the time that she last spoke to Michael to between 11 and 11:30 p.m. Deborah then said she woke up just after midnight to the sound of an alarm coming from within the home. In her groggy state, she thought that one of the family dogs must have tripped the burglar alarm, so she fumbled around in the bedroom in an attempt to disable it at the control panel. But the shrill sound of the alarm continued to pierce the air. When Deborah opened her bedroom door and saw smoke, she realized that it was the fire alarm that was sounding. Deborah stated that she closed the bedroom door and made her way out of the house through a sliding glass door onto an external deck that was connected to her bedroom. It was after she made it to the deck that Deborah heard her son Tim on the home's intercom system, frantically asking his mother what he should do. Deborah knew that Tim had crawled out of his bedroom window on numerous occasions in the past, but she told police that she advised Tim to stay in the house until firefighters arrived. She also told Tim that if he felt he needed to do something, he should go look for his younger sister. Deborah then ran to her neighbor's house, asking them to call 911. By the time Deborah had returned to the house, Kate had climbed out of her bedroom window and was standing on the roof of the garage. Deborah said she yelled out for her daughter to jump, but admitted to not catching her, with Kate landing on the ground. Deborah had not sustained any injuries from the fire. She told police that at no stage was she ever in danger of being exposed to the flames, including when she was on the deck outside her bedroom. Up until this point in the interview, investigators had noted that Deborah hadn't cried and had indeed appeared talkative. She'd been vague about certain aspects of her account, including times of particular occurrences, but she was adamant that the kids all hated their father for being unfaithful to Deborah and then moving out, even suggesting that Margaret had set the fire to eliminate the family entirely so she could have Michael all to herself. She didn't refer to her children by their names but their ages, and spoke about Tim and Kelly in the past tense. Police noted that at least an hour had passed since the interview had commenced before Deborah asked about Tim and Kelly's welfare. When it was confirmed that the bodies of Tim and Kelly had been located in the charred ruins of the home, Deborah initially appeared to be overcome with sadness, but in contrast to her ex-husband, she became angry upon hearing the news. She started yelling at the police and accusing the firefighters of not trying hard enough to rescue Tim and Kelly, saying, "Christ, I saved one kid.
I could have saved another one. I'll never forgive myself for that. Did they even try?
Deborah became confrontational, demanding that she be taken back to the family home to see the damage for herself. Deborah was free to leave after a police interview, but obviously she now had no home to go to. After borrowing some money from Michael, she went to a local motel, given there was no way her ex-husband was agreeing to have her stay with him. When Deborah's divorce attorney made contact with her later that day, Deborah was said to be extremely distressed, had an unkempt appearance, and was repeatedly asking about whether her children had died. Police made inquiries with Deborah's neighbors to ascertain whether they'd noticed anything unusual in the weeks, days, and hours leading up to the fire, as well as the night itself. Neighbors did report that when Deborah knocked on their door during the fire to ask to call 911, they noticed her hair was wet. And told police they immediately suspected that Deborah was responsible for the fire based on her detached demeanor. 2 days after the fire that claimed the lives of her siblings, Kate's paternal grandparents sat in on her interview to provide support for their granddaughter. Kate told police that on the night of the fire, she awoke to see smoke coming into her room underneath her bedroom door. She ran to the door and yanked it open, calling out to Tim, who she could hear calling out to her from his room. To keep herself safe, Kate shut the door and called 911 from her room. But as she couldn't hear anyone on the line over the piercing noise of the fire alarm, she hung up. This was the call received by emergency dispatch at 12:20 a.m., where no one was on the line. Escaping through the door and downstairs wasn't an option, so a terrified Kate took the only other route she could. She climbed out of her bedroom window into the chilly night air and onto the roof of the garage. With no idea where the rest of her family was or whether they were alive, Kate squinted through the smoke billowing outside the house, her eyes stinging and breath catching from the fumes and burning ash that were engulfing the air around her. Kate called out to her mother in the hopes she'd get a response. She felt a flood of relief when she heard her mother calling back over the noise of the wind and the crackling of the burning house. When Kate searched the darkness for the source of her mother's voice, she realized Deborah had escaped and was standing on the ground. Deborah called out to Kate to jump off the roof and into her arms. With no other choice, Kate leapt off the roof. But instead of Deborah catching her daughter, she missed and Kate landed on the ground. But fortunately, wasn't injured by the impact. Kate told police that Deborah was terribly upset during the fire and that she loved her mother, who she felt was a good role model. Kate told police that when Michael arrived at the scene, he started yelling accusations at Deborah, who was crying and desperate to find out what had happened to Tim and Kelly. Kate was confused and anguished that Tim hadn't managed to escape out of the bedroom window. Police asked Kate for some background on her parents' relationship and how things had been at home prior to the fire. Kate was emphatic that she and her siblings loved their mother and that Deborah maintained close bonds with all the children. Kate also told police that she was angry with Michael for moving out, as it upset Deborah so much she'd started drinking heavily. Painstaking examination of the scene of the fire revealed that most of the extensive damage centered around the upper section of the northern end of the house, which was where the children's bedrooms were situated. There was significantly less damage to the master bedroom. Investigators found signs of an accelerant being poured on the floors of both stories of the home, with a large amount having been poured on the floor of the living room. The flammable liquid had been poured up the hallway of the second story and across the stairs leading from the first to the second story, effectively cutting off the stairway as a potential escape route. The pour pattern of the accelerant led from the door of the master bedroom, which was not closed at the time of the fire, but open. The remains of the melted plastic were found on the floor throughout the house, which was evidence of accelerant having been carried to different rooms. An empty container of charcoal lighter fluid was found on the floor of the garage. On October 27th, Tim and Kelly were laid to rest at Highland Park Cemetery in Kansas City. Their interment followed an emotional double funeral service attended by 300 people mourning the loss of two children who had bright futures and infinite possibilities ahead of them. But one person whose behavior didn't reflect the anguish shared by everyone else present was their mother. Listener, we all understand that grief takes many forms and manifests itself in different ways, but mourners at the funeral were appalled by Deborah's behavior, Detailed in the book Bitter Harvest, Deborah swore at both Michael's father and the funeral director, while openly criticizing the funeral arrangements, saying,
"I don't need any more of this shit. Shut the fuck up."
When a song chosen by Michael was played during the funeral, Deborah was seen sticking her finger in her mouth and pretending to gag. The circumstances surrounding the fire gave law enforcement cause to classify the investigation as a case of arson, and the Eastern Kansas Multi-Agency Task Force was called in to investigate. There was no doubt that the windy conditions of the night of the fire intensified the blaze. The speed with which the fire took hold through the house simply couldn't be solely attributed to an accident. Accidental fires only have one point of origin and generally start in basements. The two furnaces in the family home were located in the basement, where the investigators also found evidence of multiple unconnected smaller fires, as well as two electrical panels and water heaters. But this wasn't where the fire originated. In a report issued by the task force early in November, investigators noted that the fire had multiple points of origin, including a suspicious area of self-contained fire in a vanity drawer of the master bedroom. Investigators deduced that the accelerant was between 3 to 10 gallons of isoparaffin, which is the chemical used in charcoal lighter fluid, the same fluid sold in bottles like the empty one found on the floor of the Farrar's garage. The evidence at the scene left no doubt that arson was responsible, with Tim and Kelly's death therefore considered homicide. In the days following their deaths, a second task force was called in to commence a formal murder investigation. Under Kansas law at the time, even without evidence of premeditation, whoever was responsible for the fire could be charged with a first-degree murder of Tim and Kelly, given their deaths occurred as a result of arson. Included in the potential pool of suspects were people who lived in the home or had an intimate knowledge of its layout. Given that liquid accelerant was used, investigators knew that the person who lit the fire would likely have sustained singeing or burning when the blaze ignited. Following forensic testing of hair samples and clothing that Michael and Deborah had each been wearing on the night of the fire, there was nothing to indicate that Michael had been present when the fire started. There is no evidence of Deborah's clothing having come into contact with accelerant, but her hair was a different story. The report by neighbors that Deborah's hair was wet was consistent with what can happen when someone uses accelerant to start a fire. When ignited, the vapors from accelerant can create a flash, which cause burns and singeing, which will often prompt an arsonist to immediately douse their head in water. Despite Deborah having cut her hair twice since her police interview, there were significant signs that her hair was singed. As investigators dug deeper into the background of Deborah and Michael's troubled marriage, they revisited Michael's previous concerns that Deborah had attempted to poison him on multiple occasions. Police decided to trace the packets of castor beans that Michael had found in Deborah's purse in September. Officers traced the origin of the packets in the Earl May Garden Center in Olathe through handwritten contact details contained in Deborah's address book. Obscura is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Fiscally responsible, financial geniuses, monetary magicians. These are things people say about drivers who switch their car insurance to Progressive and save hundreds. Because Progressive offers discounts for paying in full, owning a home, and more. Plus, you can count on their great customer service to help when you need it. So, your dollar goes a long way. Visit Progressive.com to see if you could save on car insurance. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states or situations. Listener, we all wish we had more ways to save more. Chime understands that every dollar counts. That's why, when you set up direct deposit through Chime, you get access to fee-free features like fee overdraft coverage, getting paid up to 2 days early with direct deposit, and more. Chime is banking done right. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees. Get paid up to 2 days early when you set up direct deposit. With qualifying direct deposits, you're eligible for free overdraft up to $200 on debit card purchases and cash withdrawals. Today, Chime has spotted members over $30 billion. Open a checking account with no monthly fees and no maintenance fees, not to mention access to over 47,000 fee-free ATMs, more than the top three national banks combined. My younger self would have loved Chime. Work on your financial goals through Chime today. Open an account in 2 minutes at chime.com/obscura. That's chime.com/obscura. Chime feels like progress.
Chime is a financial technology company, not a bank. Banking services and debit card provided by the Bancorp Bank N.A. or Stride Bank N.A. Members FDIC. Spot me eligibility requirements and overdraft limits apply. Timing depends on submission of payment file. Fees apply at out-of-network ATMs. Bank ranking and number of ATMs according to U.S. News and World Report 2023. Chime checking account required.
It was also revealed that a second purchase of castor beans had been made on September 20th from a different Earl May Garden Center in North Kansas City. When investigators contacted the store to see if anyone matching Deborah's description had made such a purchase, the store advised that in the month prior, a female customer ordered 10 packets of castor beans, which were at the time out of season, saying she needed them for a school science fair. But investigators found that there had been no such science fair at the kid's school. To help authorities get to the bottom of any alleged poisoning, Michael provided blood samples to police. Local testing failed to identify any sign of residual ricin in Michael's system, but the samples were sent to Washington, D.C. for more sophisticated testing. Meanwhile, Michael's medical issues continued. His previous repeated bouts of severe gastrointestinal distress had resulted in bacterial endocarditis, a heart valve infection that results from ingesting castor beans. A month following the fire, Michael underwent surgery. When the result of the blood test came back, the levels of ricin antibodies were so high that it was clear that Michael had ingested the toxin on numerous occasions. That same month, news reports started to indicate that Michael had allegedly been poisoned and that this was linked to the fire. But authorities remained tight-lipped about who they believed were responsible for either offense. The public didn't have to wait long for more details, though. And on November 22nd, Deborah was arrested. She faced two counts of first-degree murder for the deaths of Tim and Kelly, two counts of attempted first-degree murder in the cases of Michael and Kate, and one count of aggravated arson. Bail was set on an unprecedented amount of $3 million. In January 1996, a pretrial show hearing was held. Michael had given a videotaped deposition a month prior to the hearing. The Kansas City Star reported that a month following Michael's surgery, another procedure was required to treat the same bacterial condition and drain an abscess that had formed in his brain. This time, there was a very real possibility that he may not survive the surgery to testify against his ex-wife. Thankfully, 40-year-old Michael pulled through the risky procedure and gave evidence in person, telling the court about Deborah's alcohol dependency and that their marriage was loveless and uncaring. With regard to the alleged poisoning, the prosecution presented evidence that Michael's gastrointestinal condition couldn't be attributed to any one diagnosis, but that his symptoms were all indicative of repeated ricin exposure. When it came to the fire, the prosecution asserted that Deborah had splashed a large amount of accelerant throughout the house. So much, in fact, that when she ignited it, her hair was singed and her bathrobe burned. She ran her head under the shower and discarded her robe on the bathroom floor before running outside in her nightgown. The court heard how the large amount of pour and burn patterns found in the remains of the family home indicated that a large amount of accelerant appeared to have targeted the children's bedroom, closing off any paths of escape. The nature of the damage from the flames to Deborah's bedroom door and the carpet at the base of the door indicated it had been opened during the fire, contradicting her account that the door had been closed. Portions of Deborah's videotaped police interview were played to the court, supporting the assessment of detectives that her manner at the time had appeared extremely out of the ordinary. The court heard that as investigators picked through the wreckage after the fire, a novel was discovered on Deborah's bed, which she checked out at the local library. The book was about several children burning to death in a house fire that was deliberately lit. That wasn't the only recreational reading Deborah had been doing. Her library records also indicated that prior to the fire, she had borrowed several books on intrafamilial homicide. In other words, books about killing members of one's own family. Deborah maintained her innocence. The defense placed the blame for both the fire and Michael's poisoning squarely on Tim, who, of course, was no longer alive to be able to defend such accusations. It was claimed that Tim was motivated to destroy the house out of anger at Michael. This statement wasn't exceptionally far-fetched, given Michael himself had testified that his sometimes physically aggressive relationship with his son was difficult at best. The Manhattan Mercury newspaper later reported that the nanny who worked for the family for 4 years was approached by Tim one day in 1990. She stated that 8-year-old Tim had confided in her that his parents were arguing so much that they were divorcing. She also stated that Tim was so angry, he burst out that he'd kill his father and burn down the house. The Kansas City Star newspaper reported that the court heard that in 1995. Tim developed somewhat of a fascination with fire and explosives. He liked to sketch bombs and rockets, even concocting Molotov cocktails, setting a fire in a neighbor's yard, and carrying around fire-related paraphernalia. The nanny also added that on 2 occasions, she'd found Tim setting fires in trash cans, once in the basement, and the other incident in the nanny's kitchen. The explanation for Deborah's unusual demeanor, both at the scene and during her police interview, was that the medication prescribed to manage her mental illness affected her ability to respond as someone normally would when experiencing traumatic events. With the proceedings for the show hearing concluded, Deborah's arraignment was scheduled for early February 1996. Following the show cause hearing, the prosecution announced they would be seeking the death penalty at trial. Before the trial commenced, in what was proving to be one of the most sensational and infamous cases in state history, both the prosecution and the defense made numerous requests to the court about how proceedings would run. In March 1996, Deborah's competence to stand trial was evaluated by the defense psychologist, who later expressed concerns about Deborah's state of mind on the night of the fire, but declared her competent. Deborah's bail remained at $3 million. The defense applied to have the charges heard at separate trials on the basis that it was prejudicial to Deborah, and that the jury would be confused by the evidence and unable to make separate decisions when it came to the murder and poisoning charges. But this request was rejected by the judge, who stated that the evidence in all counts overlapped, citing a compelling factual relationship between the charges. As preparations for the trial commenced, the defense knew that the key to raising sufficient reasonable doubt was discrediting the evidence of fire investigators, who were of the view that the fire was caused by arson. In conducting their own inquiries, the defense found that at the time of the fire, Deborah's bathrobe was wrapped in a ball on the floor of her bathroom. Burn marks on the robe were consistent with those commonly found on clothing worn when someone lights a fire. This new revelation halted the attempt by the defense to provide doubts as to Deborah's involvement in both the fire and the alleged poisoning. Faced with an uphill battle in terms of successfully defending their client, Deborah's lawyers enlisted the assistance of her divorce attorney to see if further information could be elicited from their client. Deborah maintained that Tim was the one who had poisoned Michael and admitted to starting the fire, but was unable to provide further details as to how the tragedy unfolded or why. In the end, the case wouldn't proceed to trial. In April 1996, the defense advised the district attorney's office that their client wished to enter a plea bargain. Deborah entered what is known as an Alford plea. This type of plea is where a defendant maintains their innocence in a crime, but pleads guilty based on the likelihood that the available evidence will prove their guilt beyond a reasonable doubt. For sentencing purposes, it's considered a guilty plea, but is not considered an admission of guilt. At the plea bargain, Michael again attended court, only days after having further brain surgery to treat weakened blood vessels that left him at the risk of suffering a stroke. At the hearing held at Johnson County Circuit Court in Olathe, Deborah pled no contest to 2 counts of capital murder, 1 count of aggravated arson, and 2 counts of attempted first-degree murder. She read a prepared statement, saying,
"I am aware that the state can produce substantial evidence that I set the fire that caused the death of my children. My attorneys are ready, willing, and able to present evidence that I was not in control of myself when Tim and Kelly died. However true that may be, defending myself at trial on these charges would only compound the suffering of my family, my daughter Kate. I love my family very much. I never meant to harm my children, but I accept the fact that I will be punished harshly. I believe that it is best to end this now so that we can begin to heal from our horrible loss."
The plea bargain would ensure that Deborah would avoid the death penalty in the event of a conviction. Following the plea hearing, Deborah's defense reiterated to the media that she accepted full responsibility, but that her intent in setting the fire was not to kill her children. On May 30, 1996, Deborah appeared in court for sentencing. The defense psychologist who had originally assessed Deborah as competent to stand trial testified that Deborah was cognitively competent and capable of controlling her emotion at a basic level, but that she had an inability to process emotions at a more complex level. The court heard that the basis of Deborah's psychiatric admissions to hospital were a diagnosis of either major depression or bipolar disorder, that she had an extremely limited capacity to be able to cope emotionally. The defense psychologist was of the view that Deborah had schizoid personality disorder and told the court that Deborah had managed to maintain the veneer of being high-functioning thanks to her level of intellectual intelligence. But under the stain of her chaotic home life, her academic abilities failed to adequately mask her struggle. Deborah received 2 life prison terms for the murders, 2 8-year terms for attempted murder, and 4 years for aggravated arson, all to run concurrently. This amounted to a total 40-year term with no chance of parole, also known as a hard 40. Following sentencing, Deborah maintained that she had little memory of the events of the night of the fire. Not long after she was incarcerated, she wrote to both Kate and Michael making various claims. These included that she exceeded the recommended dosage of her medications on the night of the fire, the suggestion that Michael's girlfriend Margaret started the fire, and maintaining that Tim was responsible for poisoning Michael. Over the years, other diagnoses have been suggested with regard to Deborah's state of mind, including psychopathy, as well as borderline and narcissistic personality disorders. In the year 2000, 49-year-old Deborah made an application to the court to withdraw her no-contest plea. She claimed that from the time she was arrested, her ability to comprehend the legal proceedings against her was affected due to being under the influence of psychotropic medication. However, her request was withdrawn when she was informed that should a retrial be granted, prosecutors would pursue her under the full force of the law by seeking the death penalty. In 2004, Deborah filed another request with the court seeking a retrial in relation to the charges relating to the fire. Her claim was based on the argument that advances made in the field of fire science related to arson investigations since her conviction would prove her innocence. However, the court determined that Deborah had failed to present any new evidence to support her claim that a charge of arson had been disproved and her request for a retrial was denied. In December 2014, the Kansas City Star newspaper reported that 63-year-old Deborah was seeking a new sentencing hearing. Deborah claimed her sentence was unconstitutional, citing a decision by the Kansas Supreme Court the previous year, which ruled that sentences such as Deborah's should be determined by a jury and not a judge. The following month, the Johnson County District Court determined that the ruling could not be applied to Deborah's sentence retrospectively, and that her case did not represent one of manifest injustice. Deborah continues to serve her sentence at the Topeka Correctional Facility in Kansas, where she is currently classified as a low to medium security prisoner. Her earliest possible release date is November 2035. Only 3 months after Deborah was sentenced, Michael faced 2 more heart surgeries. Following the conviction, Michael and Kate faced a new struggle in rebuilding not only their shattered lives, but their broken relationship. One of the many long-term consequences of Deborah's behavior in turning her children against their father. Michael continues to practice medicine and remarried in 1997, but not to Margaret, the couple having parted ways in 1996. At the cemetery where Tim and Kelly's ashes are interred, a poem by Mary Elizabeth Fry can be found poignantly marking the children's final resting place. "Do not stand at my grave and weep. I am not here. I do not sleep. I am 1,000 winds that blow. I am the diamond's gilt on snow. I am the sunlight on ripened grain. I am the gentle autumn's rain. When you awake in the morning's hush, I am the swift uplifting rush of quiet birds in circled flight. I am the soft stars that shine in the night. Do not stand at my grave and cry. I am not here. I did not die.